The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
My good friend, and I must say a very talented man, Dinesh D'Souza, did a movie that is getting tremendous reviews. It's called Vindicating Trump, and it's opening Friday on the 27th, and I think it's something you should go and see. People are going to love it. It is something very different and very spectacular, actually. So I congratulate Dinesh. A lot of our friends are in it. A lot of our great, loyal patriots are in it. And enjoy it. Most importantly, enjoy it and, frankly, learn from it.
Lots to learn, indeed, in the forthcoming movie Vindicating Trump that comes out just this week. And we've got the filmmaker himself in the studio with us today. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. We thank you for joining us on today's special edition of The Trumpet Daily. Today we have Dinesh D'Souza back in the studio. It's been a few months.
Back in town, back in the studio, and excited to be here.
Well, maybe we can start by just discussing your movie. I've got the trailer we can play here in just a minute, but you were here on May 6th. A lot has happened since then. You mentioned last night that the assassination attempts did change the movie a little bit, obviously. How far into it were you back in May, and then kind of give us the lead up to July 13?
The way that a film works is we come up with the idea like a year ago, but it's only a blueprint, it's a sketch.
Right.
And then over subsequent months, we craft and shoot recreations. And the recreations are giving you a window into things you normally don't see. So in this film, we have sort of a Democratic National Committee war room. We have a media war room. Because you might be wondering, you know, here's Trump. He goes into court in New York. Let's just say he gets convicted. What does it look like at the New York Times or CNN? Are those guys high-fiving each other? Are they we did it, you know? What is their reaction? So we imaginatively recreate this and give you a window into it. So we do all this stuff. In the recreations, we also foresaw, like, what next? Mm-hmm. Okay, we've tried character assassination. We've tried lawfare or legal assassination. And the logical next step is actual assassination. Now, Tucker Carlson had said something to that effect.
Right.
I was, as you know, on a tour with Tucker in Australia. We did a tour of several cities, and we discussed this topic. So we decided to parachute a little segment of us talking about this topic, potential assassination, in the movie. And all of this is before even the first actual assassination attempt. Now, we were scheduled to interview Trump, and it kept getting pushed back because, remember, he was supposed to go into New York and be sentenced.
Right.
So we were getting a little frustrated because we realized this needs to be the centerpiece of the film. It's
right.
Trump vindicating Trump. So we need Trump in it. And almost providentially, it came through about 10 days after the actual assassination attempt and right after the Republican National Convention. So I was able to sit down with Trump one-on-one. But I also wanted to bring out a side of Trump that people don't always see. Trump is a little bit of he charges forward. And Debbie, my wife, even warned me. She said, listen, if you sit down to talk to Trump, you have 45 minutes, but you'll be lucky to get three questions off because he'll go for like 15 minutes straight,
right.
You know? And I said, no, I'm not going to let that happen. I sort of need to control the interview because I want to ask him some very provocative things, and I want people to see his mind work. I'm happy to say I think that is accomplished in the movie.
Yeah. Let's go ahead and play the trailer for the movie that comes out this Friday, Vindicating Trump. This is clip two.
Somebody has to help this country, and if they don't, the country and the world are in big trouble.
Someone's got to overturn the tables in the temple.
Trump jumping into the presidential race.
She's a bit worried.
Of the Apprentice guy? You know the feeling of power.
Could you handle it or would it devour? They fear that power. You didn't do an insurrection. Had you called for one, there would have been one.
And there would be one if you called for one now.
I'm not sure I want that power. I want the power just to make the country better.
America first!
And that scares them.
A lot about Donald Trump scares them.
Let's look at everything. Campaign, his family. Let's get foreign eyes on him.
We have one target. You know who he is.
Going after their companies, their families. That is a dictator.
It's a very dangerous time for our country.
The goal is to put him in jail because they're so afraid of his voice.
I am your voice.
We'll bury him so deep in legal, it'll bankrupt them.
Broke Donald in jail right before the election. That's
sorry for being that guy, but isn't that election interference?
It's not interference if we do it.
We just want a free and fair election.
Sounds expensive.
Ballots ain't cheap.
Wait. Did you actually say the word buy the ballots?
We were able to purchase 10,000 ballots.
That's terrifying.
They cheat in many different ways. That's all they're good at.
Ready to save democracy?
We need to stop him permanently.
And that person will be risking his life.
Too bad it's not the 60s, right?
It's the way you survived.
I said, get me up.
Trump has beaten back every attack against him.
It's like the damn Terminator.
We're going to fix our borders and we're going to fix our elections. We're going to win.
So you went in to the interview. There's a few clips of the interview with Mr. Trump in your trailer there. What you said you wanted to keep it focused. What were the main things that you wanted to ask him or to reveal with your discussion?
Well, one thing I wanted to bring out was the private Trump. And I say this because there's a side of Trump he doesn't like to show to the public or to the media. And that's kind of his inner life, the way he feels, the way he thinks. And people have tried, Dr. Phil tried to, well, right. Assassinate, how did it make you feel? And Trump immediately and instinctively like runs away from that. Mm-hmm. He doesn't go there. When Debbie and I first met Trump, this was in the fall of 2019, we got a glimpse of that side of Trump. In fact, Debbie had asked him, she said something like, you know, hey, Mr. President, you know, you get blasted and savaged on every platform, like every minute of every day. How do you like endure that? How do you handle it? Mm-hmm. You know, does it get to you? And both of us expected Trump to go, ha, 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 it doesn't get to me. These people are nuts. I enjoy it. They're crazy. But he was like, you know, he goes, at the end of the day, he goes, I got to tell you, it does get to me. Yeah. He goes, I don't really need this. I'm doing it because I love the country. I've gotten so much out of the country. I want to give it back. And this is how they respond, you know. And so when he left, Debbie and I were talking, and she was like, you know, if only the American people could see that side of Trump.
Right.
And so I was like, now fast forward to this year, I'm like, I need to bring that out. Yeah. So that was one of my goals.
Right.
And the other was to draw him into some larger themes. I mean, if you think about it, Trump is divisive, people say. And he is divisive in the sense that you've got these people over here who will take a bullet for him. They love him that much. There's people over here who cheer when somebody else tries to shoot him. So I say to myself, how does the same guy generate this intensely opposed and opposite reactions? You have to go back to Lincoln to find something like this. And even with Lincoln, I make this point in the movie and also in the book. I have a book of the same title. With Lincoln, the divide was over slavery. It wasn't actually over Lincoln. It was over the issue. But with Trump, it's over the man.
Right.
And so I wanted to tell Trump this. I wanted to tell him, hey, Link, listen, why is it, if you or I were to see an accident, and we're sitting at a cafe, we would give somewhat different accounts because we are each seeing it from our own perspective. But in general, we'd agree on the facts. And yet, on Trump, it's not like that. Mm-hmm. He generates this Trump derangement syndrome on the one side, this almost uncritical affection on the other. The movie tries to come to terms with that sort of emotionally and intellectually. And I like Trump to come to terms with that and explain it.
Yeah, I guess I had character up in the latter part of my notes. Maybe you guys could, as you say, that's evenly split. Like on the one side, he's crazy, he's deranged. On the other side, as you say, people will lay down their lives for him. This was Paul Ryan, though, I think just this weekend, talking about how he can't vote for Trump. He's not sure he's going to vote for Kamala. He's probably going to write someone in. But listen to what he had to say this weekend.
Character is too important to me.
And it's a job that requires the kind of character that he just doesn't have. Having said that, I really disagree with Biden on policy. I wrote in a Republican the last time. I'm going to write in a Republican this time.
You're going to write in
a Republican? I don't know who yet.
I mean, everyone has flawed character. It's astounding to me, though, that people like this can look at Kamala or Biden or Obama and just say, it's just, you know, they're great people. The policies I disagree with. But with Trump, it seems like it's just very personal. Like, they can't find anything about him that's admirable. Like, not even his courage. I mean, the fight.
Yeah, I mean, this needs to be taken on head on because too many people, even on the Republican side, people who are voting for Trump will say, well, you know, I don't really like the guy, but I like his policies. Or something like, you know, he really needs to shut his mouth. What they're getting at is they want like a reformed Trump, a new and different Trump. They want to remake Trump in some way. Some people will even say, Dinesh, please tell Trump to do this. Please tell Trump not to tweet that, this kind of thing. Here's my point. I think that Trump is a man of vastly superior character to Paul Ryan. I mean, I'll just take it head on, right? Here's why. People talk about Trump's vices, but they don't talk about Trump's virtues. So let's take one of Trump's vices. He was a playboy. He was a philanderer. Okay, Paul Ryan is probably not a philanderer. Now, Trump is not a philanderer now. Nobody says he's philandering right now, today, these days. He's a former philanderer. Mm-hmm. He's a reformed philanderer. Okay, that's a negative. Now, let's look at Trump's virtues. Trump is probably the bravest guy on the political scene, certainly in America and maybe in the world. Paul Ryan is a gutless coward. Aristotle says that courage is the supreme virtue for the simple reason that not only is it admirable of itself, it's required to do the other virtues. Trump has it in spades. Paul Ryan has none of it. Paul Ryan epitomizes the Republican. If Paul Ryan was facing three criminal charges, however orchestrated, he would have exited the race. He'd be under this table right now. He'd be in the fetal position, cowering. He's the kind of guy who gets knocked down and grins. Trump is not like that. So my point is, let's look at Trump in the round. You want to talk about his vices? I'm delighted to talk about them. I also insist on talking about his virtues. He's magnanimous. He's a big-hearted guy. He relates to ordinary people. He's extremely kind and thoughtful. His family loves him. So you won't find a guy working for Trump low down on the ladder. Trump will insult the people who are his equals. He'll never insult a doorman. He'll never insult a guy who's making a pizza. Those guys will never say a bad word about Trump. That's a very rare quality in politics. Most politicians are the opposite. They will insult the guy who's below them, and then they're scared of the people who can do them harm.
Right.
So they cower and they're always flattering those people. So this is a disgusting aspect of political character. And Trump comes out looking good.
Yeah.
Look at all the investigation. If you or I were investigated to this degree,
right,
our money, our family, our tax returns, and you come out as clean as Trump, where they have to go after him on all this invented stuff. You overvalued Mar-a-Lago. You know, you attacked some woman in the restroom of Bergdorf Goodman. I mean, these are like laugh out loud stupidity, just made up nonsense. So this is my point. I don't shy away from the issue of Trump's character, and I make the case that Trump's character is needed for this moment and this crisis we're living in as a country. Now, that means that Trump may not be the perfect guy for like every time,
right,
but he is the perfect guy for now.
Right. You say in the movie that we don't need a reformed Trump, we need Trump as he is. And is it primarily the courage aspect of his character that you think is so necessary?
Yes, just because we are facing such a serious threat from a regime, the Democrats, the left, that are really subverting the principles of our constitutional republic,
right? Right?
This is a threat that's not any less than the threat, for example, at the Civil War. So imagine if someone went to Lincoln and said, you know, you got to pull General Grant off the battlefield. You know, he cusses all the time. He bankrupted his family's store. He's unkind to his wife. He's a drunk. Lincoln would be like, well, I think the question is, can he fight? You know, can he lead the Union armies to victory? Isn't that the primary issue in front of us? I would make the same kind of case for Trump. It's not just a Trump. Yes, Trump is courageous, but he's also ingenious. He's creative. He's a doer. A lot of politicians are sort of masters of the memo and masters of rhetoric. They do nothing.
Right.
Trump built, you know, a good part of the New York skyline. So this is a guy who's all about getting it done. I think he's learned some lessons from the first term. And this is actually why the left fears him more.
Yeah.
What will an educated, a politically attuned Trump do in round two?
Right. Yeah, you mentioned, too, he's magnanimous and his family loves him, friends and so on. You might have, I think this is from Friday, but this was an older gentleman who went to school with Donald Trump back in the 1970s, and his dad died, and he says something here in this clip about Donald Trump's father, clip six.
About what President Trump's father, Fred Trump, did for myself, for my brother, for my sister, for my mother. 1974, my dad suffered a major heart attack. I went to the same school as Donald Trump, the Kew Forest School. 3 days after my father's burial, there was a knock on the door one school morning, 7 a.m. I answered the door. It's a distinguished gentleman. I was 10 years old. My father just died. The gentleman said, kid, call your mom. I called my mom from upstairs. She came down. Gentleman said to my mom, I am Fred Trump, Donald's father. And my mom says, yes, I know Donald went to the Kew Forest School. And Mr. Fred Trump said to my mom, yes, Mrs. Rem, very sorry about Joseph's death. And what you don't know is I'm still on the Board of Trustees at the Kew Forest School. And this morning, I let Headmaster Mr. Philip Rogers know that from this day forward, myself, Fred Trump, out of my own pocket, is going to pay for your three children's tuition.
Pretty amazing. I mean, You mentioned that he never puts down, you know, the ordinary doorman or taxi driver. And he will go head-to-head with his equals. But how do you feel like, I mean, people that don't even know him, I mean, this man's family obviously knew their family, but how do you feel like he connects so intimately with just ordinary people right across the country?
He is an unusual billionaire, unlike other billionaires. You know, I know a half dozen billionaires, and in most cases, as they become more successful and wealthier, they secede from the middle class. They develop new interests and tastes. They eat in different types of restaurants. They won't be caught dead in McDonald's, for example, right? They want to be, and their aspirations change. They want to be on the board of the Lincoln Center. They want to be seen at. So the thing about Trump is he has some of that, right? He was a massive cultural celebrity. But at the same time, his tastes are the ordinary guy's tastes. So Trump's idea of a good time is like eating two cheeseburgers with fries and drinking like a Coke, you know, not a Diet Coke, but a Coke. And so I think what happens with the ordinary guy thinks, well, if I was a billionaire, I'd like a place like Mar-a-Lago. I'd like to be the owner of Miss Universe. I'd like to be seen with Miss Venezuela. I'd like to be eating all the burgers I can eat with, you know, on my plane. So Trump, in that sense, embodies the aspirations of the ordinary guy. And this is actually why the rappers like him. Because the rappers think, well, that's what it means. Mm-hmm. That's what success means. It's embodied in Trump.
Yeah.
I think for Trump, the fateful thing, now we show this in the film, but this analysis is not in the film, but it's implicit. Here's Trump at the top of the escalator. Remember the famous scene,
right.
2015, he's coming down the escalator. I think that's a very iconic scene. It's the second iconic scene of Trump's career. The first iconic scene in Trump's career was when he crossed the bridge from Queens, where his father did business, into Manhattan. He wanted to go for the big time. That was a big decision he made. The second decision was when he went out. Think about this. It's almost like imagine Trump up here, and you've got all the elites with him. There's Ellen, there's Oprah, there's Charlie Rose, there's Larry King. All the cool people are up here. Trump decides, I'm going to exit this scene. I'm going to go down the escalator. He descends. Here's the American people. They've got some real anguish and concerns. I'm going to take up their cause against these dudes. So right away, you understand right here why a lot of people love Trump. Because they know he doesn't have to do it.
Yeah.
And yet he took up their cause.
Right.
And at the same time, you can understand in this exact same scene, in the symbolism of it, why the elites hate him, because they see him as a traitor. He was one of us. He was up here with us.
Right.
And now he's decided to go with the pitchfork people over here and turn against us. He's a traitor.
Yeah. I saw this from Grabian. He puts together clips, and we use it for our show a lot. But this, what struck me with this, I'm only going to play like a minute and a half. It went on for 9 minutes, but it was the regime media in 2017. So Trump is just getting into office. And they're going on, and as you say, before the escalator, they loved him. They wanted to go to all of his parties and whatever. Then he gets into office, and they're all talking and saying he's crazy, and we need to, you know, exercise this amendment or whatever, and get him out of office because he's losing it. And I mean, to hear this, to kind of look at the flashback and see how they turned on a dime on him, and then how rich it is for them to then 4 years later, there's an actual guy in there that is senile or at least getting worse, and they covered that up completely. So this is from a Grabian montage back in 2017, clip 4.
So now they're saying he's mentally incapacitated, and more than 24 Democratic lawmakers are backing a bill that says he should leave office.
Should he be removed from office?
His brain is simply incapable of processing the information, emotionally, psychologically unstable. Initiate proceedings to remove the president.
You and several of your Democratic House colleagues met with a psychiatry professor from Yale, Dr. Bandy Lee. She told CNN today, quote, "As the president is unraveling, he seems to be losing his grip on reality and reverting to conspiracy theories."
Dr. Lee and other psychiatrists who've been up to meet with members of Congress have been predicting increasingly delusional and paranoid behavior on the part of the president. The president is dangerous and unable to successfully meet the powers and duties of office. We got serious stuff to deal with, and instead we're caught up every day in what looks like the country debating the mental health of the president. So it's a very dangerous and unstable situation. The issue is, what is our institutional responsibility as the U.S. Congress? And we've got that under the 25th Amendment. Everybody should go and read it.
No, Trump needs to be medicated and hospitalized at this point, or he is going to just kill all of us.
People are talking about the 25th Amendment, and they're saying he's just not mentally fit to be the president. And I think if you're doing this, I mean, is there a mental fitness problem? We all know the ramifications of nuclear war.
Can Americans be concerned about the president's mental fitness?
This president is not fit.
This is 25th Amendment kind of stuff
that should have already activated the vice president and a majority of the cabinet to remove the president as unfit to serve under the 25th Amendment.
Pretty amazing. I mean, then they let go of that, and then they didn't talk about it when Biden was in there. And then as soon as Biden now is out of the picture, now they're starting to get into this again. It's 7 years on. They're talking about how unfit he is mentally.
It's very interesting for me to contrast the way I felt about these things when I first saw them mm-hmm. versus now. Mm-hmm. So when I first saw them, it would get me sort of agitated because I would be like, the extreme kind of arrogance with which you draw these conclusions. I mean, that twit of a psychiatrist, I mean, she never talked to Trump. She never examined him in any way. This was like a nakedly disguised ideological attack masquerading as a mm-hmm. professional opinion. At the time, I was, would be like, this is outrageous, this is the media. Now I watch it with the serene detachment. It's almost like if I went back and listened to Rochelle Walensky, the head of the CDC.
Right.
If you take the vaccine, you can't get COVID.
Right.
If you take the vaccine, you can't give COVID. Utter nonsense.
Right.
But at the time, these were given with Solomonic kind of confidence and authority. We've realized how nefarious these people are. And by nefarious, I mean that their innocent-sounding blunders actually have a diabolical motive. So, for example, recently Fauci said, that 6 feet social distancing rule. He goes, there were no studies. There was no science. We made that stuff up. Now, that's bad enough, right? Mm-hmm. You could say, irresponsible scientist, you're not doing your job. But I always ask the question, well, why did you make it up?
Mm-hmm.
How did it benefit you to make that up? And the answer is very clear. If people have to stand at least 6 feet apart, you can't have normal voting in this country. You can't have the 2020 election run like every previous election. People can't stand in line to vote. You need to mail out millions of ballots. You need mail-in drop boxes. So in other words, the purpose of the 6 feet lie was to fix the 20, or at least to create the environment in which the 2020 election could be stolen. So, anyway, coming back to Trump, this guy has brought out so much. He's like one of these Rorschach tests that's just brought out so much, not just about the media, the Democrats, but in some ways the institutions that we trusted.
Right.
And so he's created not just a different environment, but a different psychology, I think, in the minds of even his own supporters, like me.
You say he's learned a lot since his first term. What do you feel like he's going to do a lot differently this time around?
So I think that Trump, for example, came in and he was like, listen, we've got a lot of people with cozy deals. I think one of the things Trump taught us is that a lot of money that goes in the defense industry is just as corrupt as the money that goes into, say, welfare programs. In other words, government is inherently inefficient and corrupt. They're making side deals. There are powerful corporations that have money to gain, insurance companies, pharmaceutical companies, defense companies. Defense companies like the fact that we're constantly giving foreign aid, because we don't give foreign aid by sending a check. We give foreign aid by giving money to Lockheed and Boeing and Raytheon to make weapons that are then delivered. So it's a lucrative contract. So Trump already knew all this. But I think what he didn't know, because he was an outsider, you can't really blame him.
Right.
He didn't know that you can't trust the people in the lab coats. He didn't know that if you have an epidemic and you get the longtime guy who's been there since Reagan, and he tells you, you got to shut the economy down. I mean, first of all, think of what a sacrificial act that was. Let's say I'm Trump. Yeah. I've created this roaring economy. Mm-hmm. It's unstoppable. And if it goes like this, I'm going to win the election for sure. However, this squinty guy with glasses is telling me to kill my own economy. And yeah. Trump did it,
yeah.
Knowing that it could jeopardize his own. So I'm saying when you reflect on Trump's actions, then I hear someone go, all he cares about is himself. And I'm like, really? If I cared about myself, I would not shut the economy down under COVID. I'd let some more people die. I don't care about that. I'd make sure I got reelected. I'll say, I'll fix the country after that.
Right.
But that's not what Trump did.
Yeah. How do you, like the left is kind of panicking right at the thought of him coming back and him firing people and cleaning house at the DOJ and FBI. I mean, obviously he would appoint, you know, his directors. But do you feel like on the level below the directors or the attorney general that he would also, use his authority to clean house in those areas as well?
Yes. I think that there are rules that allow you to do this in all kinds of ways. And so there are statutes. The federal law is like an accordion. And the Democrats read it. We don't. So, for example, I recently saw just a small portion of the RICO statutes. Anyone who conspires or is involved in any way with systematic election fraud is committing a serious crime. If I was a Republican attorney general, I'd be like, guess what? That statute is going to be like my Bible passage for the next few years. I'm going to be rounding up people and charging them with but the Republicans tend to be live and let live, you know. So I think that mood is changing.
Yeah.
I think Trump has also realized that you need to send in people. And I hope he picks people like DeSantis, Vivek Ramaswamy, because these people are obsessed with bureaucracy. They're obsessed with detail. You need someone who's going to go into these institutions and like fumigate them from the ground floor. It's not just a matter of swapping out the guy at the top. They've created incentives for the guys all the way down. They get bonuses if they arrest more people for January 6th. They get bonuses for going after the pro-lifers. Mm-hmm. So that incentive structure, that corporate incentive structure that is now embedded in government needs to be changed.
Yeah. You mentioned election fraud and at the end of your film, there's a fair bit on that's kind of in the spirit of 2,000 Mules. Maybe I think this might have been from last week as well. It's our senator here in Oklahoma talking to somebody about fraud, I believe, in Nevada. This is clip 3.
42,000 people in Nevada voted more than once, according to your work in this. 42,000 people. 1,500 people voted in Nevada that were dead. 19,000 people voted, though they did not live in Nevada, and they weren't a college student. 8,000 people voted from a non-existent address. 15,000 people voted, though they were registered to a commercial address or a vacant address. And 4,000 people voted in Nevada that are non-citizens. My question to you is, in my state, when someone votes twice, and we do have that occasionally, and about 50 times a year that actually occurs in our state, we prosecute individuals that vote twice. Of this 130,000 instances that you have identified from the 2020 election in Nevada, do you know of any prosecutions currently going on in Nevada for any voter fraud?
Not yet, Senator.
So it varies from state to state, as you heard the senator say. I mean, here, you know, they would prosecute you. They just went through the roll, the voter rolls here in Oklahoma and cleared out 450,000. I mean, this is a very conservative state. Since your movie, 2,000 Mules, was that a year and a half ago?
Or? Yeah, it came out in the middle of 2022.
Yeah. Since that, have you seen, like, what has been the impact of that movie on some of these states? Has there been very many reforms?
The issue was already a matter of huge concern. That explained in part the success of the movie. But the movie took people's sort of anxiety about this, I think, to a meteoric high-rise level. Laura Trump, who's now co-chair of the RNC, told me, she goes, I can't go anywhere. This is all that people want to talk about. And so I think that the power of that movie was, even though that the follow-up investigations and so on that needed to be done were not done for the most part, the fact is that it raised the awareness. And it is true, Trump actually said to me in our conversation, not sure if I put this in the film or not, he said, you know, I told the RNC, I said, listen, you want to, in the past we focused on get out the vote almost exclusively. He goes, I'll get out the vote. You know, I'm not saying to suspend get out the vote efforts, but I'm saying secure the vote. And so this is a priority. I can say that for sure. But here's the point I think we should keep in mind. Whether it's dead people or it's illegals or people moving out of state, I don't think that the problem is corrupt individuals. Think of it. What would be your motive in wanting to vote three times? First of all, it's one vote. So you've now voted three votes. Big deal. Mm-hmm. The real problem is not that. The real problem is organized election fraud. Somebody goes, how do we get the names of all the college kids that lived in Nevada and were registered to vote in Nevada and now have gone on to live someplace else? How can we cast those ballots on their behalf? This is what needs to be investigated and prosecuted. So put it differently, it's not voter fraud, it's election fraud. Mm-hmm. Voter fraud is the voter. Like, how many illegals are gonna say, I've come to America, I'm determined to vote? No, why would they do that? No, the problem is the Democrats want to add millions of illegal names to the voter rolls, right, so that cheaters can vote on their behalf. Right. That's the problem.
Yeah, has there been, like in Georgia, we heard about Nevada there, but in some of those swing states, have you read about any improvements that they've made in cleaning up the rolls and that sort of thing?
It's a mixed bag. In a couple of places, including Michigan and Wisconsin, the political balance of power has shifted more toward the Democrats since 2020. And as a result, you're going to get less attention to this issue. On the other hand, in places like Arizona and Georgia, there is heightened awareness for sure. And other states are tightening their belts on this. So I would say on the balance, we're better off than we were in 2020. Certainly, they don't have the pretext of COVID. One of the funny lines in our movie, we have a lot of entertaining and amusing lines in the movie, but one of these guys is like, if only another pandemic, where's the next pandemic? So they look for opportunities to change the rules.
Yeah. What was it that you addressed specifically at the end of your film about the buying ballots?
Well, this is a kind of a new phase of election fraud, because the fraud can't be done the same way every time. Mm-hmm. So let's take the mules. Imagine if in 2024, in the middle of the night, people started showing up at drop boxes with a backpack full of ballots. First of all, patriots and conservatives now know about this.
Right.
So they sit at the ballot boxes with their iPhone waiting for these mules to show up. It won't work. They can't do it the same way. You have to rob Fort Knox another way.
Right.
In 2022, the Democrats figured that out. And so what they did in Maricopa County was miraculously or coincidentally, the tabulators don't work. The paper is the wrong size. And as since Republicans are all saying, let's wait till election day to vote, the disproportionate effect is to suppress the Republican vote in Maricopa County, which proves to be critical. So then we said to ourselves, all right, let us now do what good detectives do, put ourselves into the mind of the criminals. We want to hijack the 2024 election. How would we do it? Can we find a vulnerability in Fort Knox or in the voting system where if we were pulling this off, we would do it this way? Now, people will say, well, Dinesh, you're revealing new ways to cheat. No. The good thing about exposing a scheme is that once people know about it, you can't do it that way.
Right.
So, to pursue my bank analogy, if I said, well, you know, there's a back door you can get in at Fort Knox, and, you know, the guy over there, you just have to slip him some coins and he'll let you in. Then people go, okay, well, let's go check out that guy. Let's make sure we have surveillance on that back door. So we're putting out a real vulnerability that we found. I'll just mention the concept. The concept is you can buy and make ballots. It's crazy. I mean, I thought after Mules I was something of a knowledgeable guy, at least about election fraud. I'd never heard of this. And so when we hired a couple of investigators, I said to them, look, it's not enough for you to just like tell me how to do it. I want you to actually do it and show me on camera that this is something that you could actually pull off. And it's in the movie and it's eye-opening. It's an important theme in the movie, about 20 minutes or so inside a 90-minute film.
Yeah, it's a great film from start to finish. You're doing the country a great service, I think, by not just with this, but 2,000 Mules in particular, just drawing attention to something that a lot of people want to cover up. So kind of caught me by surprise as I was watching the full-length movie, and then to see that at the end, I was like, wow, they're going to try something different, something new to try
totally.
To steal it.
So initially when I found out about this, I was like, let's just make a film called The Ballot Makers, and we will just do the film on that. And we could have.
Right.
But on the other hand, we need to make the case for Trump. And the reason is Trump puts himself on public exhibit, right? He does his thing. But he doesn't do what Reagan did. He doesn't make the case for him. Reagan would say, here we are approaching the 1980 election. Here are 7 reasons why you should vote for me. Trump doesn't do that. So this film and this book, by the way, if I can give out the website, it's vindicatingtrump.com. And the cool thing is you can get movie tickets. You can pre-order the book. If you put in your zip code or your city, the theaters will come up. We are adding theaters all the time. So by the early part of this coming week, we will have 800 to 1,000 theaters. Pretty much any American who wants to go is willing to, you know, go 10 minutes or even 30 minutes away, will be able to go in the theater. And it's a sublime experience to see it there.
Yeah.
It's one thing to watch on your computer.
Right.
A whole different thing to see it in the theater and with like-minded people.
Oh, yeah. It's powerful. So that comes out Friday. The book that goes by the same name, that comes out in
October. That comes out a little bit later, early October. So if you pre-order it now, as soon as the book is available, you'll be one of the first people to get it.
Okay. VindicatingTrump.com. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll come back with Dinesh D'Souza to tell you why he's in town specifically. I mean, he's here to promote the film as well, but he's also going to be a keynote speaker at an event that we have coming up this afternoon. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is The Trumpet Daily. We'll be right back.
Daily news, Bible prophecy. See the connection on The Trumpet Daily. Are you feeling overwhelmed by the flood of news and information? You need something to sift the news and bring you only what matters most. You need The Trumpet Daily. You also need something to help you understand not just what's happening now, but what will happen next. You need The Trumpet Daily. Only The Trumpet Daily accurately matches daily news to precise Bible prophecies. Because Bible prophecy is the only tool up to the task of sifting the news down to what's important and showing you what will happen next. Join host Stephen Fleury every weekday. Go to trumpetdaily.com.
And I want to begin in Israel with the core question at the heart of this conflict, which is
Basically, whose land is it? Whose land is it? Now, I'm going to make the case that now there are some people, of course, we know who say, well, it's Israel's land because God gave the land to Israel. And this is not, by the way, an argument that can be just lightly dismissed. I'm not going to focus on it, but I do want to highlight it. And I do want to say that it is very clearly stated in the very opening books of the Old Testament that this is what God, in fact, does.
So that's from last year from Dinesh's podcast. Maybe you mentioned the film, and maybe you could also tell our audience about your show.
I do a daily podcast. It's just the Dinesh D'Souza podcast. I do it in audio and video. It's about 40 minutes long. So it's a lot of people, some people like to watch it, but a lot of people like to listen to it. And you can find it all the normal places. You can get podcasts, Apple and Google and Spotify and so on.
Yeah. You were here in May, and you got to see our exhibit, which opened in February, The Kingdom of David and Solomon, Discovered. Today, we're adding, we had a replica of the Tel Dan Stela that says House of David on it, discovered in 1993. And when we first approached the Antiquities Authority in Israel about getting the actual artifact, they just kind of almost laughed, almost scoffed. And we just kind of kept persistently going after it. And it got here last week. It'll be here for the next 6 or 7 weeks in our exhibit. And today is sort of the grand opening ceremony that we're going to have. And you're going to be the keynote speaker for this afternoon. So maybe you could start by just telling us, your interest level in archaeology. I know you have a film next year that you're going to be devoting to Israel and archaeology. You tell us a little bit about your interest in it and just the impact that the exhibit that you saw in May has had on you. Your wife's taking a look at it right now, even.
So. She is. Yes, and we're excited about doing, this will be a departure for me because my films have tended to be cultural and political, but this will be a foray into some new territory, but I'm very excited about it. It's interesting to me on multiple levels. I became involved in sort of debating some of the world's leading atheists about a decade ago. The way that happened was I was just sitting at home, and I turn on the TV, and I see a guy I know from the political world, Christopher Hitchens, at that time, along with Richard Dawkins, probably the world's leading atheist. And he's debating a pastor, and he's sort of mocking the guy and having fun with him and so on. And I realized that this is not a real debate because the two of them are talking different languages. Hitchens is speaking the language of academia, the language of sort of a reason, you might say. The pastor is invoking scripture. These are two ships passing in the night. So I send Hitchens a message, and I go, hey, it was sort of one of those pick on someone your own size type messages. But I was like, why don't we have a debate? And he was like, oh, Dinesh, I remember we had debated capitalism versus socialism in Georgetown. So he's like, I remember our debate from the old days. Let's do it. So it turns out Hitchens and I did about 8 or 9 debates on leading campuses, drew huge crowds.
When was this?
This was in about between 2008 mm-hmm. and 2012. Okay. In that 4-year period, I must have done 30. Debates. I debated, I debated Dawkins on a media show, but I debated the philosopher Daniel Dennett. I debated Sam Harris, the sort of neuroscientist, Bart Ehrman, who's kind of he's a Bible scholar, but a Bible scholar kind of from an unbeliever's point of view, and a number of other people. Very interesting debates covering a lot of topics, engaging a lot of academic disciplines, including history, including philosophy, including physics, cosmology, but missing one topic, and that is sort of archaeology. Mm-hmm. And I must say, I was, even though I thought a reasonably well-informed guy, I knew about debates around the Big Bang. I knew about debates around Darwin and followed those very closely. Does evolution in some way disprove or discredit the idea of God? But I was kind of a blank slate on the issue of biblical archaeology. I knew that some of it was going on. I just mm-hmm. didn't know, like, what did it find that was interesting or definitive? It wasn't until Debbie and I and our family made a trip to Israel in the end of 2022 that we got our first kind of exposure to the findings of, mm-hmm. of biblical archaeology, but not just the interesting findings here and there and here and there. It was that there were prominent scholars and archaeologists who said that the way they do archaeology is kind of with the Bible in one hand and their archaeological tools in the other. So if they're looking, let's just say, for example, for Sodom and Gomorrah, they don't just go out and start digging. They look in the Bible,
right.
And the Bible will tell you certain things about Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, Abraham was over here, and what he saw was a mountain, and there was, and they use the biblical clues as a map. Now, at a certain level, this makes total sense, right? Let's say you're trying to discover if there was or wasn't a Trojan War, and if you're trying to discover whether this was real, mm-hmm. and how you would find out that if there was a Trojan War, where did it occur? Well, what would you do? You'd obviously take Homer. You'd start out with the Iliad and the Odyssey. You would look for clues, and you would then, obviously the clues would have to be verified. Mm-hmm. You'd go and see if you could find those places. So at some level, this is not a theological enterprise. It's a scholarly enterprise, but it's treating the Bible seriously as a work of documentation and a work of history. So in any case, this was all quite new to me. And extremely engaging. Mm-hmm. And then we met some people in Israel. I had Zev Ornstein from the right. From the City of David Foundation on my podcast. You guys spotted that
right.
and then wrote me a letter.
Yeah.
And at first I had trouble believing that there was an outpost in America that was really plugged into all this.
Yeah.
But once I got here, of course, I was like, this is very interesting. And so that's why I was happy to come. And that's why I'm delighted to be back.
Everyone that we know in the world of archaeology has commented to us, how did you do this? How did it get a place in Oklahoma of all this? I don't think a lot of people think very highly of Oklahoma as sort of this touristy, you know, lots
well, you
of...
Well, you do know that there's a movie called Twisters that is... Twisters 2, isn't that what it is? So that's giving Oklahoma its reputation, but you're right. I think it is a stunning achievement to have it here. It's priceless. It is a window into a whole field, but I think it's also a window into a... whole changing worldview, if you want to call it that. That's what I'm going to talk about a little bit later today. And that is, this is not just about an artifact and an inscription. And, oh, isn't it interesting that there really was a City of David? It is interesting, but why is it interesting?
Mm-hmm.
You know, posing the why question is key. It's key in any analysis. Let's take, you know, for a moment, we talk about Trump. You know, people say Trump's a dictator. And I go, well, he didn't call for an insurrection. He didn't do anything dictatorial that I can see when he was in office. But it's interesting that you use that charge against him. Nobody called Reagan a dictator. People would say of Reagan, he's a washed-up movie actor, you know, but they wouldn't call him a dictator. So the reason that they deploy that accusation is interesting, and there's something behind it. Same here. What does this artifact, what is the world that it opens up, and what's the significance of that? That's what I want to go into.
Yeah, sounds great. We got a couple minutes. Coming back to Donald Trump, since you brought him up there, have you talked to him or texted him since the second assassination attempt? I guess that was just a week ago.
For sure. I mean, when he issued the statement for our movie, I basically sent him the film,
uh-huh.
and I go, hey, check this out, see what you think. And of course, we do communicate. I can't claim to be, I'm not like one of his confidants, and I'm independent in that sense. However, I maintain a direct line of communication with Trump and with the Trump people.
Yeah. The article that you had at American Thinker, you talked about the character assassination was first, and then the legal assassination or lawfare, and now we're to actual assassination attempts. Do you feel like, I mean, you talked about cheating on an election and how they come up with different ways to do it. Do you think there's going to be any other, you know, more creative ways to try to actually take him out between now and the election?
I mean, let's just say that if Trump gets across the finish line in November, as I think he will, It is the left is going to go nuts. I mean, I don't think we can expect a second Trump term to be any less turbulent and rocky than the first term. These are people who have somehow convinced themselves that they are dealing with Hitler circa 1933. Now, they're completely, the things that they say are insincere beyond belief. And so when the first assassin, for example, misses, thoughts and prayers for Donald Trump. I'm like, well, you're the guy who's been calling him Hitler. If Hitler survived an assassination attempt, would you send him thoughts and prayers? No, you would actually be glad. In fact, your only regret would be that the assassin missed. And yep. I think that is how quite a few people do feel about Trump, but they can't say that.
Yep.
So their rhetoric is designed to mislead.
Yeah.
So I think, yes, I think Trump, you know, this guy, you have to say that there is some primal force pushing him forward simply because, I mean, think about it. If you and I had Mar-a-Lago, we're in our 70s, we've got, you know, 10 years maybe left of life, we have our grandchildren. Why would you subject yourself to this? It's not a normal thing to do.
Yeah.
The criminal indictments by themselves, let alone the two assassination attempts. And as you know, I talked to Trump about this in the film and bring out what I think is his true motivation. And his true, unlike almost every politician who is in it for gain, I think Trump has nothing to gain. And his supporters know that. And if people thought about it, they would realize that there is a profound unselfishness driving him forward.
Yeah. He said this, I think this is clip 9, guys. He said this last week on X.
And nobody ran. In fact, they're standing up. Some of them are standing up looking for the shooter. The other one has to get credit to local law enforcement. It was a gentleman that shimmied up to the roof, looked, saw the man with a gun, and probably made him go faster than he would normally go. And so he didn't exactly hit the target the way he wanted. There's something going on. I mean, perhaps it's God wanting me to be president to save this country.
He said the same thing on Gutfeld's show last week as well.
Well, I like what the pundit Scott Adams goes. He goes, I think God is doing early voting. Very witty. I wish I thought of that. That's a good one. But yes, there is the, when you gauge the probability. I mean, thinking of an AR-15, and you know, I've shot an AR-15. I'm no shooter, but that's a gun with which you can't miss.
Yeah.
You know, you just point, little red dot tells you where to aim, and you pull the trigger. And this guy got off multiple shots.
Yeah.
So it's it was a close thing for the country, not just for Trump.
Yeah. Sundance at Conservative Treehouse said that the Secret Service for the second one at the golf course, that he almost stumbled upon the guy's rifle that was in the bushes and was going to shoot through the fence. Here again, just like the first one, from our standpoint anyway, we feel like there's the hand of God is at work here. I mean, he kind of alluded to that.
Yeah, and W is like Dinesh. I mean, you know, if you are in that situation, I would try to yank you so fast out of that arena. Whereas look at Trump. His reaction is twofold. Number one, he's annoyed that it's interrupted his golf game. He's like, I was about to do this amazing putt, and they start yanking me off. Number two, he goes on social media, and he just posts the following, 0-2. I mean, he's keeping score. And so that is there's a fearlessness behind him. And my point is, his enemies know that. This is actually why, you know, he's like the old Western movie where the solitary gunfighter comes over the mountain, mm-hmm. and all the gangsters know right away that's our problem right there. Not the old fat sheriff with a toothbrush mustache. We can handle that guy easily. This guy is our problem. This is where we have to concentrate our force. And so this is my point. Paul Ryan is like the fat old sheriff. Right? Nobody cares about him. He doesn't scare anybody. No one's tried to assassinate him because it'd be a waste of ammunition. But but with Trump, he's a danger. He's a very scary guy, in part because of the way he reacts to things. And so coming back to the issue of character, I look at Trump's character in the round and I go, not that this is a guy without flaw, but it's to the unbelievable good luck of the wimpy invertebrate Republican Party that this solitary gunman has come over the horizon, and we might as well use him to get rid of the gangsters, and after that he can ride off into the sunset and he's made Shinbone great again. But it would be an act of supreme idiocy to say things like, we don't know anything about his family. He's a little bit too happy to get into conflict. He needs to fight like us. Well, if he fought like you, I mean, that's how you got in the miserable situation in the first place, where you need somebody to come in from the outside.
Do you feel like just to shift gears a little bit, do you feel like the two gunmen were connected to the deep state in any way, or do you feel like they were just incited by the rhetoric from the radical left?
Well, certainly that. Certainly were. I mean, character assassination and actual assassination go together.
Yeah.
Very often the one sows the seeds for the other. Now, I'm speaking here with a certain historical perspective.
Yeah.
I mean, when the when they wanted to assassinate Charles I to put him in front of the guillotine, they began with character assassination. And then they tried lawfare. Mm-hmm. You know, they passed all these bogus ex post facto laws, essentially making crimes after the, in other words, making crimes and then retroactively applying them to the king. And when all of that failed, actual assassination. Mm-hmm. So the one leads to the other, leads to the third. So there's that. But there are, when I look at particularly the first assassination attempt, I say I can understand a measure of incompetence. So, you know, female DEI agents prancing around, not properly blocking him. They don't know how to put the gun in the holster. I get that. That's DEI straight out. That's organized incompetence. And that happens in corporate America, too. But there are other things that are more creepy. So people at the rally tell the cops, there's a guy on the roof.
Right.
He's got camouflage. He's got a backpack. He's got a gun. Why Trump wasn't yanked off the stage immediately is a good question.
Yeah.
Moreover, if you looked at the counter sniper that took him out, took out Crooks, that guy had Crooks in his sight before any shots were fired. He had him in his sight.
Right.
He waited for Crooks to get off not one but multiple shots, and then boom, he got him. Now, at one point I heard, and so far this has never been confirmed, and I don't even believe it's true, the Secret Service has a policy that you never shoot first. That's nonsense. That makes no sense. How do you protect a president if you allow assassins to get off their shots and then you go get them? That doesn't make any sense. So these are the kinds of things I would be investigating to see if, you know, look, I don't think that someone in the government said, we need to find an assassin. Let's go find this 20-year-old in Pennsylvania named Crooks. No. But a more sort of sly possibility is they know that there are certain kooks out there.
Right.
And they're like, you know what? We're going to look the other way. This guy's looking to go up on this roof. Somehow we'll leave that roof uncovered. Let's see what happens.
Yep.
So that would be, to me, a more plausible potential scenario. Obviously, it requires a lot more investigation to confirm if something like that is what happened.
What do you make of that, that poll last week that found that 28% of Democrats believe that for the good of the country, that he should have been assassinated, that it would have helped, and then 24% on top of that said they needed more time to consider whether or not him being assassinated would help the country.
So this shows you that the message of the Democrats and the media does sink in to a degree. And the people who mindlessly say this don't realize the political firestorm that they are, in a sense, kicking off. Because, look, in all these things, too, can play at this game, right? In other words, the Democrats, for example, have perfected this formula, which is, let's find a blue state. Let's find a jury pool that hates the guy. Let's indict him. And then let the jury know you can bring out all your vengeance and prejudices and hatred and lock this guy up for 10 years. All right. Well, we can do that to the Democrats in hundreds of counties in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no question that that's going to be starting if this keeps up. So it's two can play at this game. And the Republican Party is toughening up as we speak. I mentioned it's a wimpy, it's invertebrates. That's how it has been. It's been full of Paul Ryan types. That's its temperament. You know, that's how we got Ryan. That's how we got Romney. That's how we got McCain. That's how we got Dole, George H.W. Bush. I mean, talk about a parade of namby-pambies, but we're becoming less namby-pamby-ish, and it's a good thing.
Yeah. Well, all the best with your film. I guess you're going to be out trying to publicize that for the next few weeks. Or?
Yeah, I'm going to probably right through the election. To be honest, I'm just going to be out there spreading the word and spreading the message and alerting people to what's at stake.
Well, we're delighted that you took time out of your busy schedule to join us for the grand opening with the Tell Dan Stila, and then to take some time to spend with us on this program as well. Dinesh D'Souza, very, very nice to have you in the studio again, second time this year. You are listening to Stephen Fleury and Dinesh D'Souza, and this is The Trumpet Daily. Thanks for joining us on today's show, and we'll see you tomorrow.